Hi, this is David Rutledge. Welcome to Earshot on RN and another episode in the series Retrospect, featuring the stories of six Australian veterans of the war in Afghanistan, as well as their families, perspectives from partners, parents and children. This program traces the experience of Louise O'Sullivan, who was a psychologist with the Australian Army. Louise went to Afghanistan three times between 2010 and 2012 as part of a unit that offered counselling for combat soldiers and other servicemen and women on the ground. You'll also hear from Louise's parents, Catherine and Dennis O'Sullivan.
My boyfriend in high school actually joined, and then I thought, you know, like, I wonder what I could do as a female in the military to, I don't know, assist in some way. Yeah, then some girl at high school had a book on psychology, and that's when I decided I'd do psychology. Mm. Because before that, my parents thought I was going to be a beauty therapist. Yeah, at 17, it was the week after schoolies, I think, I went to Kapooka and joined as a reservist. Yeah, I eventually decided that once I completed my degree, I would go full-time.
The battle is now joined on many fronts. We will not waver, we will not tire, we will not falter, and we will not fail.
Classes are over for the day at Tarin Counts Main Primary School. Next door, Australian Army engineers are helping to build a new high school.
Concern growing that the Taliban is making substantial gains in the war in Afghanistan, Kevin Rudd has today announced an increase in
the deployment of an extra 450 Australian troops. This will increase Australia's deployment to 1,550.
What you will find in defence is that most people will join because they want to deploy, and that's certainly how I felt. Part of it was about becoming part of the family of defence. Mm. And it's the thing that, you know, keeps you saying yes to deployments when your family and your partner are all saying, no, don't go, don't do it.
We were trying to be... to appear to be excited for her, because she was a bit excited to be going, and it was a big challenge and an opportunity for her. But we were also informed parents. We knew that the planes there come in on a very steep angle because of the risk from being shot down. We also knew that the trip from the airfield to the green zone was where IEDs were often exploded. And we knew that going out to bases was full of risk as well.
By the time it was time to deploy to Afghanistan, I think I was 25 the first time I went, and I'd already been to Timor a couple of times, and I already had this gist of what it was going to be like and what it would be about.
But also they have to plan their funeral, who will speak and where it will be and things like that. Very confronting, because you're trying not to think about the possibility that they will die. Up until that point, my biggest fear had been that she'd be injured. Yeah. So that's quite a confronting conversation to have. Louise rang me. She didn't want to upset her mother. It was hard.
It's a really beautiful place, and when you land in Tarin Kot, you're in a basin, and so you're surrounded by beautiful mountains, and as you're coming down, you can see the surrounding town and just how close it is, or the city, but you can also see the local farmers and children. You can also see the base, and I felt really excited. I was going to go see my friends again.
I did have one friend that would say, you know, I don't know how you can let them go. Well, I don't know how they think you tell a 25-year-old, you know, that this is their chosen career and, hey, put it on hold because your mother doesn't like it.
A lot of people, when they knew it was a girl, said, oh, well, I wouldn't let my daughter go there, and how do you feel and how do you cope? And we would say the truth. We try not to think about it. If we think about it, we don't cope, so we just put it to the back of our mind.
I'm a feminine sort of person, so I always made sure that I took things that made it look nice. so some nice smelling products for my hands, and I would take a quilt for my bed, and the boys used to come in and say, it smells like girl, and I would think, only for the next 5 seconds, because you smell so bad.
And music on your iPod or iPad?
Yeah.
What sort?
I'm the least cool person alive. I listen to Simon and Garfunkel and Passenger, and yeah, I'm a bit of a folk music girl, so that sort of stuff I really enjoy. And then obviously in the gym, the kind of smashing, crashing sounds that the boys like to listen to. So, you know, day to day, I think the most important thing is just to establish a routine. So I would get up and I would run, and then I would have some breakfast. And the important thing about having breakfast was to choose the cereal that had the least sugar, because American cereal has like 40% sugar, and it's just so unpalatable that my mum then would send me over muesli, but if you didn't keep it high enough from the ground, the mice would get it and stuff. So I had like a whole trail of mice coming through my room, and eventually I started to kill.
She has a weapon called a Steyr, and it has a see-through magazine. And at some one stage, because she didn't like guns, she didn't have bullets in it. So hearing about the sexual assaults and so on, I would insist that she held up the weapon so that I could see that it was armed on Skype. It's hard to tell your girl that she needs to carry a gun.
I never experienced, you know, and I feel very sorry for the people who did, but I never experienced males treating me badly. For the most part, you know, they'll even apologise when they use poor language, but it's not like it's nothing I haven't heard already.
The men of the Australian military that went with her were incredibly protective. Many of them called themselves part of Louise's protective service. They were genuinely, honestly looking out for her. But an IED doesn't care, does it?
The Afghan National Police were sort of almost co-located, and they would come in and out and do training. And my best friend, he was in charge of their training. And so he and I had this lovely sporting kind of relationship. We would always be teasing each other and doing things like that. And one day I accidentally did that in front of one of the Afghan nationals, and he threw his coffee at me, and that was because in his mind I'd done something terrifically disrespectful to clearly in a jestful way say something to knock a man, and so he threw his coffee at me, and I really had to work hard to calm my friend and say, no, you have to remember here I've done the wrong thing, and we need to be much more careful in the future. Because it is, at the end of the day, it really is, it's their country and it's their culture, and his reaction was appropriate to him, whether I think that that's a nice way to treat women or not.
Australians are also mourning the deaths of three commandos killed in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. Seven other Australian soldiers were injured, two of them seriously. The accident is the biggest single loss of Australian lives in the war in Afghanistan.
January 2010 would be the first time that I went just solely to Afghanistan for one of my deployments. So that was when I was working with the commandos. That was a terrible time, that deployment. Initially we lost Snowy and Smithy, and immediately after that was when the helicopter crash happened. It's a very difficult time. It's, you know, 16 hours a day of hearing some really terrible trauma. You know, I no way compare what they went through to what I went through, but, you know, you still have that level of hurt and distress.
We were sending parcels at least once a week. Fortunately, anything under 2 kilos was free. Louise would say, I'm counselling X, Y or Z, and they would really like some sweets or some of your cooking, mum, or stuff like that. These were more morale food, you know. I think Louise used that in her counselling as well, you know. Breaks down the first meeting, I think, and then maybe they can share and she can heal a bit better.
Oh, look, my mum's amazing. She would always send things over, and that's my mum. Yeah, but I think she found it hard to talk, whereas my dad, I've always, you know, been able to have some of these conversations with. And but that doesn't mean that you can call home at any time, because there's just, you're doing this or you're doing that or you're doing the other. And as a psychologist, your focus is so much on everyone else that it almost feels as though, well, there's nothing I would have to call home about.
Louise was always really good at trying to ring us every week, and you sort of kept it very general. And, you know, when we got to Skype, that was great, because, you know, you could sort of put into perspective if you get to see their room and their things like that. Sort of like boarding school on steroids.
There would be times where I'd call them a lot, times where I wouldn't call them much at all, and times where they really didn't understand what was going on and I felt, you know, angry because of that. Or
in the beginning, you got one phone call once a week. While that was wonderful, it certainly isn't enough. And what do you talk about? What did you do at work today, Lou? I counselled people who'd lost an arm or a leg. No, you don't want to bring that up. You didn't have long enough to say all the things that you wanted to say, and you didn't want to hang up. And you knew that there was a line of people behind her, and so that she couldn't say all the things she wanted to say. It got better when Skype came in and you could see her face and you could tell the emotion. Email is fairly cold. This happened, that happened.
Three of my deployments were with the Special Forces. There's a sense of isolation, not in the community, because I developed with the group that I went with, the 2nd Commando Regiment. I developed really lovely ties with them from a psychology perspective, and because of confidentiality and things like that, you're very isolated. Mm-hmm. So I think I went twice in 2011. That was when one of the companies lost 3 guys in 3 months, all on a Monday and all in one province. One was an IED and 2 were shot. Yeah. People would say to me, like, oh, do the guys talk to you at all? Like, surely they wouldn't admit to a woman, but I think they actually do more because, you know, there was a time where I was deployed with another male, and lots of people tried to change onto my program. I think for that reason, it just felt more okay to tell me.
What about when Louise was over in Afghanistan? Did the ADF provide you and Catherine with any communication?
There was a helpline, and we had a couple of phone calls from a lady who was to be our first port of call. But the unit left from Sydney, and that's where it's based, and that's where their support was. So for people who were outside of Sydney, it was difficult for the army to provide social opportunities for us to get together with parents of other people who were overseas. But I also think it reflects military thinking. I've sent someone overseas, I need to provide help, I provide help, it's here, move on to the next thing. Rather than, this is not a task on an agenda, this is people, and people need to be dealt with differently to tick, done job.
There have been solemn ceremonies to welcome home the Australian soldiers killed by a rogue Afghan soldier in Afghanistan last week.
The last deployment that I was part of, 2012. Yeah. So many big things happened on that one. You know, we had the green on blue. We had...
Tell me about... What is the green on blue?
So a green on blue is when one of the ANA kills one of our soldiers. Blue is effectively our soldiers and green is the training army. And so that had happened the same night as the helicopter went down. And I was at a forward operating base anyway because another of our soldiers had detonated an IED and lost both his legs. So I remember that quite clearly because I was at the base and I was in the headquarters and the radio went off and we were all aware of what was going on and put to stand to and things like that. And I could hear it happening. And, you know, I knew that some people that I really cared about were on that mission. And so I got up the next morning and it just so happened that the OC, the major who ran that particular camp, that's the point at which he told me that, you know, 2 commandos had passed. And he didn't have the names, but he'd set up a separate area for me to be able to find out and also to do what I needed to do because I had to organise 2 responses at a time.
It is with a very heavy heart that I confirm that another Australian soldier has been killed.
The Australian Defence Force is yet to release the name of a 24-year-old Special Forces soldier killed by an improvised
explosive. The Chief of the Defence Force, Angus Houston, announces Australia's second military casualty.
Three Australian soldiers were wounded on the weekend in a series of blasts from improvised explosive devices.
The reports mainly centred on injuries and death. Sadly, you get things like five soldiers were killed. We won't release the names till we've spoken to the next of kin, and you just hope that you're not going to get a phone call or a visit. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit of a wait. We didn't need to hear it. We didn't listen to it. We just tried not to think about it, to put it in the back of your mind, to be busy, to avoid it. Mm. That's one of the strategies we used.
Very much when Louise went in between the phone calls, I'd just try and forget about it. When she contacted you the next time, then you're really happy to hear from her. But in between, if you were worrying the whole time, then that's going to cause her to be anxious. Mm. And every time you heard that there was somebody else died, you know, just shut it, because you know the flow-on effects of that to all the people, you know, that were with them, and, you know, then to the job that the psychologists have to do to debrief and, yeah.
The deployments that I did were in, you know, a short period of time. So it was maybe 10 deployments over 5 years. There's no time to develop relationships at home and have those things. You do, you get disconnected. Mm. And my parents weren't so used to me. I was so impatient and so easily frustrated and so independent that, you know, if my mum had baked cookies back then, I would have been like, you don't need to do that for me. It was really difficult, you know, and I know there was a time where I wasn't as kind as I should have been to my family. Mm. You know, I could give so much warmth in a session and compassion and things like that, but for a long time it sapped a lot of my ability to give warmth elsewhere.
Over time we could see there had been an effect on her. You know, she needed more time alone, and she was quieter and sometimes more moody or even a bit short-tempered. So there were times when we had to walk on eggshells, and there were other times when it was just a sheer joy.
You could see as the number of deployments went on that she was different. And you can tell. You can see if someone's a little more edgy or, you know, more easily upset or something, and you needed to be able to give a space. And as a mother, you know, you often ask the wrong questions and you don't let it go, and so you have to learn to let it go.
You know, 2.5 months of working these really lengthy hours, I came home to then do 3 months of every single day. And in fact, in the first year I worked there, I had 5 weekends. It's so unhealthy, and it really wore me down.
We've never tried to say we understand. We've just tried to say we're here. And that's the best we can do. In a way, it became a bit easier each time she came back and she had been safe. But it's hard when you have a daughter who's in your mind still a girl. And I knew she was making a difference, and I was proud of that. I just didn't want her to have those sorts of experiences form who she'd be.
So I came home in 2012. It was a different boss. My boss had just changed, and the stuff that I had done to organise my RTAPs and my team's RTAPs, mine had fallen through the cracks.
And just describe what an acronym RTAP is.
Oh, it's the Return to Australia Site Screening that everyone goes through before they go home. I returned home. My boss didn't have time to have an interview with me and talk to me about what had gone on, and I complained quite deeply that I needed this screen, and I had organised to have it with an external psychologist so I could be open and honest. And they said, well, no, you're going to need to do it with someone here or not do it at all. And I thought, I can't do it with someone here. I'm about to take command next year. I'd also been told that my leave days were too high, clearly, because in the last however many years I hadn't been able to take very much. And so I was basically then sent on 3 months leave, and I travelled Europe, and, you know, I'd walk through the streets of like Rome or Italy just crying, and I thought, no one knows me, so it doesn't matter. And so then I returned home. I'd gone to my boss and I told him I wasn't okay and that, you know, I needed some help. And initially he was quite supportive, but then when it started to take, you know, up to more than 2 months for me to get my referral to go out, and I just wasn't doing very well, and I conceded to him that I'd been taking Valium that a friend had given me and it wasn't prescribed, and I eventually got to the point where I said to my boss, I can't work for you anymore. You don't get it, you don't seem to care. So then I had to write to the chief of army and say, I need help. And if I'm a 30-year-old major in a unit which is almost comprehensively psychology staff, and I am now the subject of, you know, ridicule and rumours and implications, as well as being unable to get support myself, then what is a sapper going to do?
These people come from a culture where to ask for help is the last thing you do. And if they give everything and they come back and they put up their hand and say, I do need some support, then they really, really do. And it's not freely given. Yet some of them freely gave their lives. And they will carry that forever. And the army wants a free ride. Well, thank you very much for your service. You're on your own. God help you if you don't have support.
After that, the medical system did come through, so I presume there was some pressure put on, and I got what I needed. But in terms of my unit, you know, they did lots of things to circumvent entitlements and to put me on leave without pay, and rather than convalescence leave, and not talk to me about what my entitlements were. And it was hostile. It was severely undermining.
I think they treat people who have physical injuries much better because they can see and touch and recognise that. But anyone who doesn't have an injury that they can see, they're suspicious. It's a difficult thing for people to carry because no one can see that you have post-traumatic stress. It's a scar that you bear.
And I've got to say, it's not everyone, and there are some units out there that are so supportive of their people, and there are individuals who are really supportive of people. It's the institution, it's people who want to judge.
We wanted her out of that environment that had created this issue, out into where she wasn't under enormous pressure, where things weren't life and death. We wanted her just to come home to a house, go to work 9 to 5, leave work at work, and just be a person, not a soldier. And we were happy when it happened.
All I wanted to do was transfer to reserves, and they kicked me out completely. And, you know, my personal belief about that is that they felt it looked very bad to have a person in my position with the condition that I had, and who was willing to be vocal. And they want to be able to say, you know, our PTSD rates are very low, our suicide rate is very low, and the best way for them to do that is to discharge you. But the discharge itself really leads you into a place of, you know, this dark aloneness.
And when someone's medically discharged, if you don't volunteer to do it, it gets served on you, sort of.
Yeah, that's right. often over the Christmas period, I see a lot of soldiers who've had it over the Christmas period, so they don't have anyone to consult and access to try and assist them with. There is a redress process. For guys with significant pain management issues and mental health problems, you're not in a place to try and fight for your position.
And when the news came through of the medical discharge, what was your reaction?
I just thought, here they go again. You know, Louise wasn't looking to get fully out. She was looking at, you know, being a member of the reserve and continuing to be able to help others. And the army just seems to react the same way every time.
Unless you can get a disability pension, I think that they open the door, they push you out, and you change into civilian clothes, and that's the end of the story. Good night, nurse. That's it.
It is difficult to accept that the army wouldn't see that they need to help everybody. They should be looking after the complete person.
We have no fond memories. We want no mementos. It's over. That's it.
You know, in stressful situations, I now know how I behave and how I react and where my mind goes, and it's made me an extremely efficient person. But there is still a really heavy place in my heart for how I was treated and the rumours that went around about me. You know, this was 13 years of my life, and did I waste it? Which I know to be untrue now, but there are a lot of other things that was part of your whole identity. You know, I was an army psychologist, and now I'm just a psychologist. But that's okay, too.
On RN, you've been listening to the second program in our series Retrospect, War, Family, Afghanistan. This episode featured the story of veteran Louise O'Sullivan, a psychologist with the Australian Defence Forces for 10 years, and we also heard from Louise's parents, Catherine and Dennis O'Sullivan. The program was produced by Michelle Rayner, with assistance from Belinda Lopez and sound engineer Carey Dell. Original music composition was by Una Sherrard. Thanks to the veterans and their families for their involvement in the Retrospect series, which is part of a larger project created by ABC Radio Multiplatform with partners the Australian Research Council, the University of New South Wales, the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Australia Council.